This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Now, will you join me in an attitude of prayer? Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. This morning, we remember the words of Rabbi Abraham Heschel. Just to be is a blessing. Just to live is holy. Too often, we make grandiose plans about how our lives would, could, or will be. We map strategies. We enlist the help of others. We ignore warning signs and push ahead with our plans. There's an old saying, which I've updated a bit for this church, which runs, when human beings make plans, God, the ground of our being, or the mystery beyond all mystery, laughs out loud. No one likes the idea of their plans not working out, but if laughter is added to disappointment, it's possible to engender scorn. Fritz Perl, the famous Gestalt therapist, had a book entitled Don't Push the River. The problem is we sometimes forget there is a river whose streams may glad the city of humankind. We forget that we are not separate from the cosmos that surround us. And as surely as the flowers follow the sun, we rise each morning following that same life-giving light. We seek more consciousness. We seek more awareness. If a person in a rowboat sees another empty rowboat drifting toward them, they take an oar and gently push the empty rowboat aside. But if the rowboat drifting toward them is occupied, voices are raised, shouts of warning arise, and before we know it, two people are battling each other in the middle of the stream. Let us be empty rowboats as we go through our hectic days. Let us see others as empty rowboats also. Let us feel the currents of life and flow with them, remembering that rich or poor, black or white, Republican or Democrat, our ultimate destination is universally the same. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. This morning. The first is from Genesis, the 32nd chapter, the 24th through the 29th verses. So Jacob was alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower Jacob, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched, and he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he replied. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God, you have struggled with men, and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him. Second reading is from Matthew, the 5th chapter, 3rd through the 12th verses. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons and daughters of God. Blessed are those who when men persecute you falsely and say all kinds of evil against you because of me, rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets that were before you." A Chinese farmer came out one morning to find a beautiful stallion grazing in his pastures. His neighbors ran right over and congratulated him on his good luck. The Chinese farmer replied, "Could be good news, could be bad news." Shortly thereafter, the horse ran away. The neighbors came over with their sympathy for losing such a fine horse. The farmer replied, "Could be good news, could be bad news." The following week, the stallion returned with four beautiful horses. The neighbors congratulated the farmer on his extraordinary good luck, and the farmer replied, "Could be good news, could be bad news." Now, the farmer's only son was gifted at training horses, and he had trained three of them when he was bucked off the fourth, landed on his leg, broke it at the knee and the hip. He would walk with a terrible limp the rest of his life. The neighbors ran over with food and condolences, and the farmer replied, "Could be good news, could be bad news." The warlords of the region were fighting the warlords of another region. They traveled throughout the region, conscripting all the young men. All the young men from the farmer's village were drafted, except a farmer's son who was unfit for military service. The neighbors came over to sympathize. You know what the farmer said. In the war, all the young men of the farmer's village were killed. No one came to congratulate or commiserate. I recently spent 2 days and three nights in the Berkshires. The foliage was at its peak. The section of the Berkshires is known as the lung of Connecticut. The majority of the wooded hills and mountains belong to the people of Connecticut and are held in trust by the state. No one can cut the limber, plow the undergrowth, or otherwise disturb these nearly pristine forests. I was there to visit with William Spear. I'm not surprised that you haven't heard of Bill Spear, but he's a mover and shaker in the world of disaster relief, especially disaster relief for children. When I was studying at the Yale School of Drama in 1990, Bill called me from Chelyabinsk, Russia. There was a great need for blood since the meltdown of the Chernobyl reactor, and Bill had made arrangements with the Yale New Haven Hospital, and I transported the blood from the hospital to the airport. The blood would be flown to Chelyabinsk in the rural mountains of Siberia, that town considered at the time to be the most polluted and ravaged city on the planet. Bill went there to work with the thousands of children dying from leukemia. He went without a visa because it was a closed city, and he was the first American allowed in. There he spoke with hundreds of physicians and nurses throughout the region and established a rather extraordinary program still in existence today, which feeds and supports 300 people a day all through volunteer work. He was received by the mayor of Chelyabinsk and given a key to the city, a city considered the most ravaged and polluted in the world, and was made an honorary member of the staff of the hospital where the program takes place today. To this day, Bill continues to work with the medical staff that attends to the thousands of children dying from leukemia and the effects of radiation poisoning. I had gone to the Berkshires for one reason only, because I wanted Bill to come to the First Unitarian Universalist Church and be our distinguished speaker for spring of 2008. I'm here to report that he has agreed to come on the idea that we would invite him, of course, the church, not just me. As he put it in an email to me, he said, "I'm happy to have you back in my life, and as for the spring of 2008, I'm in. I'll just have to change that appointment I had to have my teeth cleaned." The man is not only a great humanitarian, but has a droll sense of humor. While I was there, I went ahead and had Bill check me out, because he's a health expert. He does Chinese medicine. I was concerned when I went to see Bill because I thought there were life-threatening issues in my life, and as it turns out, there weren't. That's good. Bill was surprised to hear from me after 15 years, and when he realized I had a clean bill of health, he said, "You know, people don't usually drop back into my life after 15 years unless they're in crisis. You don't have a physical crisis, so it must be spiritual. Bill Spear is head of the Fortunate Blessings Foundation. The term Fortunate Blessings is associated with the symbol for wind, just like the story today for our children. It's associated with wind in the Asian art of feng shui and based upon the I Ching, an ancient oracle. The I Ching identifies the primal qualities present in the universe and all beings, and the quality of wind signifies the blossoming of energy, prosperity, expansiveness, and potential transformation. In the name of Bill's organization, Fortunate Blessings symbolizes an openness to the experience of gratitude for whatever life brings. Fortunate Blessings symbolizes an openness to the experience of gratitude for whatever life brings. Bill was with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross when she was dying. Oprah Winfrey did a program on the famous psychologist and an innovator in the field of death and dying. The television crews traveled to Elizabeth's house, and many people were there on the program to thank her for all the work she had done in the area of our mortality. Bill said that when the program was over and the lights had been taken down, the television personalities had departed. It was just he and Elizabeth, him sitting by her deathbed, and she looked at him and said, "I've failed." Bill looked at her and asked her what she could possibly mean by that. She replied that there are two courses in death and dying. One was the course on how to help people through their impending deaths. That course she had designed and passed with an A+. The other course was on being able to receive the love and affection of those who wished to help you when you were dying. In that course, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had failed miserably. She stayed angry till the day of her death. This isn't surprising. People who give are giving because that's what they know how to do. This doesn't mean that they are also able to receive. I'm a person who has trouble receiving. Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. Jesus knew. What I want to tell you now is a story. It's one of Rachel Naomi Raymond's stories from Kitchen Table Wisdom. It's the last story in the book called Final Lesson. These are her words. When I first met Thomas, he was over 70, a family practicing physician who had been in solo practice for almost 50 years. Whole families from grandparents to grandchildren looked to him for help in their trouble, counted on his counsel, and called him their friend. He looked the part too, gray-headed, kindly, his body as spare and gnarled as an ancient oak tree. At the time we met, he proposed that we open a series of conversations about his life. He had done some reflection in recent years, but he felt that sharing the process at this point might be helpful in preparing him for his death. Thomas felt death to be an unqualified ending to life. Raised a Catholic, he had left the church early and embraced science as a way to bring order into the chaos of life, and science had not failed him. It surprised me that a man this altruistic and compassionate and reverent toward the life in others, this man awed by the beauty of anatomy and physiology, held no religious or spiritual beliefs. Curious, I asked him about the circumstances under which he had left the Catholic Church. Open and frank about other details of his long life, he was reticent in the extreme about this. He had left at 16 over a specific happening. I never found out what it was. Very early on in our discussions, I asked him how he saw his relationships to his patients. Looking at a small figurine of a shepherd with his flocks that a patient of mine had given me, he smiled and pointed to it and said, "Like that." The shepherd was a steward of the life in the flock. He protected them from danger, helped them to find nurture and fulfill themselves. He delivered their young. He found strays and brought them back to the flock. Thomas told me many stories of his shepherding and his life of his flock. He examined these stories. We examined them together, sharing our thoughts and perspectives. In the telling and the reflection, he seemed to be unfolding a much deeper sense of what his life had meant to others. what it stood for now. In these discussions, he often used the old Victorian phrase, they sheltered with me. He was their safety, their support, their friend. He was there for them, constant, vigilant, trustworthy. The person of the shepherd emerged as a symbol of his wholeness. Who did he shelter with? Who was the shepherd's shepherd, I ask? No one, he said. The words holding more pain than he had expressed before. It became clear he did not believe there was a place for sheltering for himself. Shepherd though he was professionally, personally, he had become separated from the flock, a non-participant, a lost person. He seemed unwilling to go much further than this. Puzzled, I ask him to make up a story about a lost sheep. Haltingly, he described the lamb that had been lost for so long that he did not even remember there was a flock. He had learned to survive by himself, to eat what was available, to hide from predators. I asked, does this lamb know that his shepherd is looking for him? No, he replied, the lamb had done something very bad and the shepherd has forgotten him. As a shepherd yourself, I continued, would you look for a lost lamb who had done something bad? He seemed puzzled. I reminded him of the young patient from the projects he'd told me about, the one he had taken on as a guardian for the juvenile courts, the girl who had eventually gone off to college. I asked him why he had gone after her and brought her home. Why, he said, she was one of mine. On Christmas Eve, I received a call from his hospice nurse. Thomas had been in a coma all day. Would I come? As soon as I saw Thomas, I knew that he was dying. His breathing, always labored, had become shallow and intermittent. The nurse with him was young and seemed to be a little uncertain, so I invited her to stay as I talked to him. He did not respond in any way. We changed his sheets, made him more comfortable. Then he sat down. We sat down together to wait. Gradually, the space between his breaths lengthened, and finally, he stopped breathing. There seemed nothing more to do. I stood for a time at the foot of Thomas's bed. I thought about him, wishing him well. Then I left. It was dark and cold, a dark and cold Christmas Eve night. Holding my keys in my pocket, I huddled into my car and my coat and walked a little faster. I had almost reached my car when the church bells throughout the city began ringing. I stopped, confused. Were the bells ringing for Thomas? Then I remembered it was midnight. The shepherd had come. On the website for Fortunate Blessings, there is a quote from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. It says, should we shield the canyons from the windstorms? If we did, we would never see the beauty of their carvings. Life has a way of carving us into shapes that are appropriate for who we are and the pressures that we're put under. As some of you know, I traveled to Washington, D.C. on the 13th of October of this year to visit with the Regional Subcommittee on Candidacy. I wasn't worried about this meeting. Don't forget, I'd been before Grace Presbyterian when I was a Presbyterian, and Grace Presbyterian's name is ironic, to say the least. Those people were just about anything but full of grace. Yet I had passed that committee and began the process of becoming a minister of word and sacrament. Then when I switched to the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, I had had three meetings with folks from the Brazos region. True, the head of the region committed suicide a month after I had my meeting with him. But since I don't believe in magical thinking, I was sure our meeting had nothing to do with his demise. The other two meetings with committees from the Brazos region had produced no more suicides, and as a matter of fact, I had rather enjoyed those committees. They'd always given me good feedback on what my strengths were and the areas of weaknesses that I might work on. When I decided to come over to the UUA, I had only one meeting with the Brazos region left, my ordination interview, and of course, I passed that by. So on my way to Washington, D.C., I wasn't as worried about this meeting with the RSCC as I was flying on Friday the 13th. Yeah, I'm a little superstitious. When I got to All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., if you ever go to Washington, you must visit this old, wonderful Unitarian Universalist church. It was just a Unitarian church back then in the 1840s. I knew I didn't want to rush into a meeting all out of breath and harried, so I went early. I sat in the Thomas Jefferson pew in the main sanctuary at All Souls and wrote my thoughts out, about what questions might be. If you were here last week, you heard those thoughts. I had so much time that I practiced my Tai Chi for 20 minutes. Believe me when I tell you that when I entered that meeting room, my feet were solidly on the ground and I was not afraid. They asked me if I'd like to say some words before they lit the chalice. I did. I quoted something from The Death of Empedocles by Holderlin. Some of you know I like this. And openly I pledge my heart to the grave and suffering land. And often in the consecrated night I promise to love her faithfully until death, unafraid, with her heavy burden of fatality and never to despise a single one of her enigmas. Thus did I join myself to her with a mortal cord. Committee started out by asking me two questions about someone who wasn't in the meeting. I thought this was pretty strange, but I decided to answer. The questioning continued, and I thought all in all it was going rather well. At one point, someone asked me something I didn't know. So instead of BSing my way through an answer, I simply said, "I don't know." When they called me back into the room, I was shocked to find out that they were not going to offer me candidacy. They considered me inauthentic, poetical, and seething with an undercurrent of anger. I looked around the room to see who they might be talking about. The odd thing about these declarations was the fact that only two people out of the 10 at the table were able to look at me while they were being read. Of course, the gentleman who was reading them looked at me, and there was one young black woman two seats from my left who was able to make eye contact with me. The others sat with their eyes cast down in their laps. They seemed to me to be ashamed. When the meeting was over, I walked around, shook each person's hand. I thanked the two who had been able to look at me. Yes, and I thanked them loud enough that the others heard. The upshot of all this is, much to my surprise, the Regional Subcommittee on Candidacy for the UUA had unwittingly handed me a fortunate blessing. Could be good news, could be bad news. And like Jacob in the Hebrew Bible lesson this morning, I have wrestled with men, I have wrestled with God, I have wrestled with Satan, meaning, of course, I've wrestled with my shadow self. And in the process, I've been mightily blessed. They recommended a year worth of counseling and told me I needed to get an authentic view of the UUA since, obviously, my view had been tainted by, and these are their words, by being paid more than over half the members of the RSCC had ever been paid, and by serving the third largest congregation in our region, a congregation larger than most of them had ever served. My mother told me that when God closes a door, he opens a window. My mother never quite got those sayings right. But I know what she meant. The window that's been opened for me will be gently stepped through, not jumped out of. It's a privilege to serve this congregation. I will continue to serve you as your shepherd until July 31st, but it looks very much like I will return to more familiar pastures where the majority of the sheep look to the great shepherd. And you know what? That's just fine by me.